George Bernard Shaw, in the years that have passed since he left us, and now that never again will we hear the news that a fresh piece of writing has been dispatched from his study to help straighten out this untidy world, we find it good somehow to summon up the memories that survive. For Professor Herman Feiner of the University of Chicago, the memories of this incredible man go back to 1923, and he is waiting now to chat with us about those days. Monitor goes now to the University of Chicago and our host, Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr.
During the past week, Chicago has been the center of a celebration carried on by lovers of plays and books and ideas all over the world in honor of the 100th birthday of George Bernard Shaw. New World last week keynoted the festivities when we brought you a transatlantic discussion by some internationally famous authorities. Today, we're winding up the celebration with a contrast. A personal visit to a much-admired senior colleague who knew Shaw well and worked with him closely. His name will be very pleasantly familiar to many of you. It's Herman Feiner, and Professor Feiner, in addition to his eminence as a political scientist, has made the brilliance of his teaching and his conversation available to thousands of Americans through radio and television. Any excuse is welcome when it gives us a chance to visit with you, Professor Feiner. So I was particularly delighted to be reminded that you were a friend and associate of Shaw's and would be willing to talk about him. Now, you've already told me that the acquaintance with Shaw started in 1923 when you were a young lecturer. How in the world did a young man beginning his career get to know George Bernard Shaw?
It goes back to the politics in which Bernard Shaw was immersed. The political party leaders in England are always on the lookout for some potentially bright young man who's just coming out of the university. And I had just taken my degree in the early 1920s. I had become a kind of unpaid research assistant to Sidney and Beatrice Webb, the great democratic socialists. And the acquaintance came about in this way, because I said to them one day, musing as it were, "You know, there are three people I'd give my life to see." And they said immediately, "Well, who are they?" I said, "Well, one is Anatole France. The other one is John Morley, afterwards Viscount Morley. And the other one's Bernard Shaw." And they said, "Well, we can't do anything about Anatole France. He lives in Paris. And John Morley is now rather aged and feeble, so he won't receive visitors. But Bernard Shaw, he comes here to lunch almost every week." This was in their house on Grosvenor Embankment, not far from the House of Commons. And they said, "The next time he comes, we'll send you a postcard." And sure enough, in less than a week, I got a card that Bernard Shaw's coming on Tuesday to lunch. Will you come at 12 o'clock and we'll spend the afternoon together? And that's how it began.
You know, in a little while, I'm going to ask you some questions about your view of Shaw over a whole life span and about the totality of the man. But I am fascinated at this point by the kind of impression Shaw must have made on young people who met him as you did. Were they profoundly admiring and immensely impressed by him?
Well, you couldn't help feeling that you were in the presence of a very great man. He himself always used to dilate upon the influence of mind and character, what Max Weber has called charisma, charm, in fascinating other people, and partly making them revere or a little afraid. And this would happen. I mean, he didn't want to make you afraid out of unkindness, but his sheer magnificence, his physique, his elocution, and his glance, his eyes, the Mephistophelian beard and the rest of it were immensely impressive, dominating almost. At the same time, he radiated gaiety and kindness on occasions of this kind. And this is what happened on the first time that I met him. You were dominated by his ideas, by his wit. He told a wonderful story, and he mainly urged, this was 1923, was urging the Webbs, who were connected with the Labour Party, and the Labour Party had just come into office, to recognize Russia, be the first ones to do it. The whole time, the whole of that afternoon, egging them on to pull wires so that should be done.
And were people anxious to copy him in many ways? Were you anxious to follow his ideas, to emulate him in all kinds of ways?
Our generation was very much concerned with equality. And that was Shaw's, the doctrine that he preached, equality. In doing this, and in any of his arguments and debates, he would twitch his nose, the end of his nose, and he says that he could make his ears twitch too. But at any rate, some of my young friends were so enthralled with Shaw's manner and with his doctrines that they, as it were, thought that they could express the contents of his mind via the tip of their nose. And all that remained of Shaw's wonderful brilliance of aphorism and ideas in the end was to see these people make a point, which was very blunt, and reinforce the point by the sharpness of the twitching of their noses. And I'm afraid that with many of them, that's all that remains in 40 years.
I hope you were proof against this kind of imitation.
I was born with a snub nose. I can't do anything about it.
And were there other ways, too, in which they strove to imitate him?
Well, I may tell you one of the ways that concerned me. Shaw was always insistent upon mustering his own physical and mental resources for the purposes which he was convinced were right, fanatical in these. And he would dominate his own physique and do all the necessary things to achieve his purpose. His physique was not good when he was a boy or a young man. He suffered for some time in his 20s with tuberculosis of the bones of the leg. He learnt that it was necessary. He went to the British Museum Library and read there the latest monographs on how to treat tuberculosis. He learned that it was the opposite from what the medical practitioners in England were doing. They'd said, wear thick and heavy clothes, stay indoors, don't get fresh air, keep away from drafts, eat plenty of good, fattening, enriching meat. He found this was making him worse. He learned from these monographs to do exactly the opposite, to be a vegetarian, to have the utmost fresh air, to wear that sort of loose woolen Jaeger wear, as they call it. And in addition, he made himself, when he could afford it, a little summer house in a garden which could revolve according to the direction of the sun, and he worked there. Well, this raised the question of writing on what paper. The white paper was too brilliant for his eyes. So he brought green writing paper and always wrote on that. I was inspired to buy green writing paper. I've still got the green writing paper left. It's right in my files in this very university. But I'm bound to confess that I would be happy and go down on my knees if on that green writing paper I could have written one page of all the thousands of brilliant ones that Shaw has written. Well, that's the kind of thing that would happen, you see.
I won't go so far as to compare you to Shaw, Mr. Finer, but I say you've done pretty well on writing paper, whatever the complexion of it.
To be a worshipper of virtue, and I think Shaw would have agreed with this, is in some sense to share it.
Of course, and since you've raised this question of his concern for his own physical welfare, I'd like to deal for just a moment with some aspects of Shaw which, in our veneration and honor of Shaw this week, we perhaps have neglected a little. The things that are sometimes described as the crotchets or foibles of a great genius, aspects of Shaw's personality which people have derided, perhaps, or regarded merely as sort of unfortunate accompaniments. You take a thing like his insistence on vegetarianism, for example. Is this important, or is it just a foible?
No, I think this is important. I think that Shaw, with all his paradox and the rest of it, was a highly integrated person. His physique, his mentality, his purposes were integrated. And he undertook vegetarianism when he realized that by this he could go above his natural physique and accomplish the writings, attend the debates, write the plays, and do all the work that was in him. He says somewhere, when I've done all this, you can throw me on the scrap heap. But I want every atom of value out of my human spirituality that can be obtained. If it means that I've got to control myself in various ways, if I've got to eat vegetarian food, why, I'll make the best of that, and I will submit myself to my own rule of civic virtue. So it is not just a foible, it's not an eccentricity. other socialists of his time were doing this too. They were the people who liked the life in the open air, who looked to a peaceful and prosperous world with almost an anarchical democracy. And Shaw wasn't an anarchist. On the contrary, he wrote a pamphlet on the impossibilities of anarchism. But you see, he was a very... he was a man who would sacrifice his baser appetites in order to do those things necessary to fulfill the higher purposes of his own destiny. And that is the essence of Shaw. It leads you right into the kind of life he wanted to live and the kind of life he thought other people might be helped to live by his arguments and by his theatre.
You let me pick up the word that you used a few moments ago, the word integrated, and move that idea into the whole realm of Shaw's thinking. Sometimes we hear a rather unflattering account of Shaw's ideas as a whole series of random, capricious dogmas and affirmations of one sort or another. Now, as a student of Shaw's political thought, for example, do you think that there is real integration? Do you think there's real system in Shaw's thinking?
There is a clean-cut integration. Never mind, as it were, the barnacles on the ship. And they're not barnacles either. They're diamonds and rubies. They're the studded jewels on a vessel that had a destination and a purpose and a compass and a proper steering wheel. If you want to put it in a nutshell, I think you can take the tension. There are two tensions which can be used as the pivots around which this kind of discussion could go. One is that he expected people not to look for happiness, but for virtue. Now, that makes that at once gives an integration to all your thoughts and ideas.
This is a thoroughly Puritan kind of notion.
Absolutely Puritan. So Puritan that he said once, it submits you to a life of self-sacrifice to make yourself something better than you feel yourself now to be. But the man who sacrifices himself deliberately for a purpose of this kind has no hesitation about sacrificing others. And the Puritans in England never did in their civil war.
Now, this makes Shaw out to be a kind of zealot, a kind of inelastic dogmatist, the sort of accusation one sometimes hears directed against him. Was there any leavening influence on this?
There was the leavening influence on the other side of his character, that he did have goodwill towards human beings. He wasn't callous and cold to them. But I think there's something underlying that, too. That's a definite element. But underlying this is another thing, that no man can be only the extreme example of what he is in the main. I mean, you can't be a complete ascetic without dying. You can't be a complete voluptuary without having a short life and an ineffectual one. But in your libido, in your unconscious, there are other elements which are perhaps not entirely controllable. Your wit, your ebullience, your sheer joy of existence, which comes out too, and which you can use, I think, as Shaw used, when you become very conscious of it, to implement these other sides of you. Your intellectual side, for example, your puritanical and side that wants human progress, because you use this as a lubricant. You use this as a method of expression, as a method of engaging other people's attention. You use it as a flirtation. Wouldn't you think so?
Yes, this somehow echoes what has already been said about Shaw, your last term, flirtation in particular. The fact that Shaw was, if not above all else, at least at all times, a showman.
A great showman. And he began being a showman deliberately when in the 1880s, that is to say in his early 20s, he went from one debating society to another in England. After all, they were free of charge. You didn't have to pay a membership. They were glad to get another member. And practiced. Began very nervously, by the way. And I may tell you that I heard him in his 70th years saying to someone who said, "How do you feel before a lecture?" Nervous. Terribly nervous. As nervous as I did on my first lecture. And then they said to him, "Well, why?" And he said, "If I didn't feel nervous, I'd be upset. Because I realized that this is my own personality wanting to achieve at least the best of my standards of before."
And yet you once told me that Shaw loved, above all else, debating.
He loved debating. Debating on any occasion. This was, and this is not necessarily a deliberate technique of uttering his philosophy. It could be, and was, but this wasn't deliberate. He just liked debating. Say he was a contentious fellow. I mean, he got joy out of contention. Wells, who was one of his contenders, once said that he got joy out of inflicting the pain of contention. I don't think so. He just liked a gay, old, Donnybrook fair fight. An Irishman, in short. He trailed his coat and said, dared you to step on it.
For a moment now, Mr. Finer, I am going to talk to you as a political scientist.
Yes.
And a student of political ideas. You've already given us a picture of the integrated personality of George Bernard Shaw. You've suggested there is genuine consistency and integrity in all of his political thinking and his thinking in all of these directions. Could we examine for just a moment the consequences of his basic position? What were the kinds of things he believed in about society?
Well, first of all, he was a rebel against Victorian respectability. The last person who says that in his plays is Doolittle in Pygmalion, which, by the way, I played in London at the University of London Dramatic Society. I was the dustman. and that was bound up with the capitalism of the English system. It was bound up with a not complete democracy, as in America, but with an oligarchic or aristocratical democracy. It was bound up with a party system. And these institutions got in the way of the social equality, which was his basic tenet. They got in the way of his social equality that was his basic tenet. And therefore, as time went on, and he saw, like many French revolutionists after the French Revolution, that in spite of all this, human nature wasn't much better than it had been last decade and the decade before, then his mood would change. It alternated according to what was happening in the world. And then he would go for a revolutionary and forceful overturn of institutions in order to establish a planned and nationalized economy with equality of income, all with the exception of a few people like himself, the elite, who deserve the rent of ability. This was his basic point. But in the end, basically, he had enough common sense. That was that side of his face. He used to say his face was asymmetrical. One side was severe, the other was good-natured. But his good nature was a fundamental thing for England and Europe of its time, that he had his dreams, as in Back to Methuselah, of what human nature could be if you really could uproot all this system.
It's sometimes said, of course, that he was merely a spokesman, albeit a remarkably brilliant and talented spokesman, for the ideas of others, for the ideas of people like the Webbs. Does this do justice to Shaw?
No, it doesn't do justice to Shaw. The maximum that you could say, if you wanted to say that he wasn't original, was to say that the others thought the same things about the same time. That Shaw was a genius of expression, and Shaw soared above the great political leader on the Labour side of that time, Sidney Webb. Sidney Webb was a civil servant type, a bureaucrat, a statistician. Shaw sailed above the statistics, and it shone particularly in his attitude towards Karl Marx. He accepted the prophetic side of Karl Marx, namely that the class system was in the way, especially in England, with its snobbery and the rest, in the way of human progress. But his criticism of Marx, by the use of modern Jevons' theory of utility, was original and, in my opinion, helped to deflect labor in England from what it might have become, Marxian or syndicalist, as it did on the continent. And that, to me, is a contribution original to the Fabians.
So that if we discount all the charm and all the literary genius, you feel that Shaw was a political scientist, a political thinker of the first water.
I think he was a political thinker of the first water in this sense, that he took up, via the topics of his time, all the fundamental political, philosophical issues. Just discussed them with great penetration and with enormous brilliance and acceptability, and did for Western democracy in the 20th century what Aristotle, I think, had done with the oligarch for Athenian democracy.
This brings us to the brink of a final question that might perhaps end our entire week's celebration of the Shaw centenary. It is the question of Shaw's survival.
Well, I have no doubt whatever about the survival of this dramatist who is the greatest exponent of English drama since Shakespeare. He may fall far below Shakespeare for aesthetic reasons, but there is no one between Shakespeare and him that comes near to the peak of his genius. And so it is bound to survive. The topicality of the times, that does not matter. What matters is what you do with the topical things, whether you see them sub specie aeternitatis, and that is what he did.
Thank you very much, Mr. Finer, for this report on George Bernard Shaw. I think, in a sense, that Shaw himself is fortunate in the reporter that he's had today. We've heard today in this discussion of George Bernard Shaw from Professor Herman Finer, political scientist at the University of Chicago. Let me take just a few closing seconds to tell you again that New World has had printed a pamphlet containing the two unusual programs by which we observe the centenary of Sigmund Freud. These pamphlets, including the remarks of Ernest Jones, Princess Marie Bonaparte, and others, can still be obtained by sending 10 cents in stamps or coin to New World, University of Chicago, Chicago 37, Illinois. Simply send 10 cents in your request for the Freud pamphlet to New World, University of Chicago, Chicago 37, Illinois. And now this is Edward Rosenheim returning you to Monitor in Radio Central.
Thank you, gentlemen. New World calling back memories of an older world, an era that already seems as remote as Victoria's well-modulated century or the years when our own North and South set the pattern for the centuries to come. We'll try to make some of that pattern come alive again shortly. And taking our cue from the political conventions that will be starting in a few weeks, we'll look in at some of the more interesting conventions of the past. But right now, let's orient ourselves to the present. With a switching cue, electronically speaking, you are on the monitor beam. Take one. News coming up in a few moments. I can see through the big glass windows into our newsroom here, and I'm always struck at this time each week how closely the scene resembles the city room with a final edition ready to roll. The phones are still briefly, and the typewriters are quiet. The last new lead has been written, and the final corrections, updating is the word, have been made. But they all watch the news tickers, for in seconds the whole picture could change. This is Al Capstaff, and as I was saying a moment ago, we'll try to catch up with some of the excitement of the earlier political convention shortly, with music and cheering and a brief excerpt of a famous voice speaking famous words, Williams Jennings Bryan. Right now, everybody duck while the broom swings over.
This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.